everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Valentine's Day. And when I think of Valentine's Day movies, I think, of course, Valentine's Day, the movie, The Wedding Singer, Hitch, you know, your romantic comedies, if you will. But there have been other movies released on Valentine's Day that maybe you're thinking, why did they release that on Valentine's Day? Silence of the Lambs. It got the Oscar for Best Picture that time, which is really strange also because of the fact that it was released in February, and that rarely ever happens. Daredevil, awful movie. But, you know, does wear a bright red costume. A Good Day to Die Hard, the least successful of them all. Wayne's World was also released on Valentine's Day. And then we have this one that I'm going to talk about. Dracula. Yes, it came out on Valentine's Day, 1931. But it kind of makes some sense because the Dracula legend has often received kind of like a doomed lover approach in the many years since Bela Lugosi made his vampire screen icon. I was going to say aristocratic. I guess he was, in a sense. But it was released on Valentine's Day, 1931. It ushered in this golden age of horror, and it also established Universal Studios as the home of movie monsters. We had had Bram Stoker and this huge, I could go into a whole episode about the legal thing about Stoker's estate, well, actually his wife, going after everybody who ever tried to make any kind of Dracula film. But Universal said, let's do it. And what they thought was, Universal was kind of out of money. It's the Depression. And said, well, we need to do this. But we need somebody who's really, really good at directing. So let's go get Paul Lenny, a German filmmaker. But he died in 1929 before the project could get off the ground. So where are you going to go? Who are you going to get? You got veteran silent film director Todd Browning. And he was known for his successful collaborations with Lon Chaney. And he had wanted to bring Stoker's novel to the screen since the early 1920s. And in 1930, he would get his shot. And Dracula made a huge amount of money. But less than a decade after directing Dracula, Todd Browning was basically a victim of his vision, and also he had a bunch of personal demons. He was born back in 1880, and he was the second son of Charles Lester Browning and Lydia Jane Fitzgerald Browning. But his uncle, I don't want to say he's more famous than Todd, but his legacy is more famous than Todd, even with Todd directing the Bela Lugosi Dracula. So his uncle is Pete the Gladiator Browning. And you guys are going, who is Pete the Gladiator Browning? And why is his legacy more so than Todd Browning and Dracula and Bela Lugosi? Well, Pete was a professional baseball player. And he was a top hitter for the Louisville Colonels. And he loved hard liquor. And that's also kind of something that his nephew followed. But Pete the Gladiator Browning was one of the greatest baseball players of the 19th century. And his skills with the bat made the difficult art of hitting a baseball appear easy. 13-year career, won 3 batting titles, finished in the top 3 9 times, was one of the pre-modern era's greatest hitters. And his real first name, everybody called him Pete, but his first real name was Louis. And he lived in Louisville. And he is the namesake for the Louisville Slugger. And the company shaped the first ever custom-made bat based on his instructions. Now, Browning's athletic prowess was overshadowed by his drunken adventures, struggles off the field. He was a champion bourbon drinker, and he led a life littered with eccentricities. During games, he refused to slide. He would often stand in the outfield on one leg. He drank Tabasco sauce, washed his eyes with buttermilk, named his bats after biblical characters, all in an effort to improve his hitting. But he had, some people say, syphilis. Others say he had mastoiditis, which is like this physical ailment that robbed him of his hearing and deprived him of an education and led to his heavy dependence on alcohol. And he was famous for giving crazy, crazy quotes. But one of the things that's, for a guy who is this legend, we don't really know that much about Pete Browning's, I don't know, personal life history or anything like that. But because of the crazy interest in Todd Browning and all of the research that has been done in his movies, as, you know, a tangential aside to that, we have learned a great deal about the rest of the Browning family, you know, including Pete. And the state of Kentucky didn't require the official recording of vital statistics until 1911, so no formal birth certificate exists today for Pete Browning or any of his six, possibly seven siblings. Nobody's really sure how many. But because, like I said, of Todd's, you know, the fascination with him, there have been so many biographers that have dug deep into this. And that's kind of how we know. Oh, and as a Valentine's Day note, Pete's parents were married on the day after Valentine's Day in 1849. Now, Todd Browning had a knack for entertaining from an early age. As a member of the choir at Louisville's Christ Church Cathedral, he delighted the congregation. He would sing. He was great. But he discovered, you know what? I can also use my talents to make some money. And so during summer vacations, he would put on elaborate plays in his family's backyard shed. He would do musicals. He would do dramas. He wrote them. He directed them. He acted in as many as five productions per summer. And he charged an admission of a few pennies for his theatricals. But he learned a lesson that would serve him well. Show business is profitable. He also learned that audiences were willing to pay more for bigger and more spectacular entertainment. So his kiddie shows regularly outgrossed those of his neighborhood competition, not just in money gross, but in gross. Also, it's crazy. And there have been quite a few books written about him. One of them is The Monster Show. And they basically, in all the books that are written about him, he would originally get paid in pins, as in P-I-N-S, and later he got paid in pennies for these summertime productions. 10 cents was a good profit. And basically, he discovered that if you give the public a run for its money, the public is yours, body, soul, and breeches, and this embraces both sexes of said public, for both sexes are now wearing breeches. And that's from the Louisville Herald Post in 1928. Browning is a very interesting character. He enrolled in the boys' high school, but he never graduated. He wanted to put on an act, and Louisville was a central port of call for the great showboats, as well as the carnivals and theatrical stock companies that traveled from town to town. And it's also obviously the hometown of the Kentucky Derby. And because of the Derby, it attracted hordes of gypsies. And Todd Browning just, I don't know, he had a powerful attraction for them. And despite his parents' warnings, he would go visit the gypsies and to some extent won their trust. The gypsies were clannish. They didn't really like outsiders. And they felt that the larger culture existed only to be tricked, bilked, exploited, and scorned. So Todd Browning's 16 years old, and he becomes infatuated with a dancer, a so-called sideshow queen in the Manhattan Fair and Carnival Company, which was at that point visiting Louisville. And sexual attraction made him finally say, I'm leaving. And in the summer of 1896, he ran away with the traveling show. I mean, that's what he did. He went up and down the Ohio, Mississippi rivers, and he basically, to get a job, took the second lowest level in carnival life. He did the barking for a phony wild man of Borneo. And whenever I think about carnival and barking, I think about, what is it in, it's Christmas Vacation, I think. Yeah, he's barking for the yak woman. Ooh, she sure can cook. But fake wild men were only one rung removed from the absolute bottom of sideshow attractions, and that was the geek. Generally, it was a alcoholic, and what the so-called geek would bite off the heads of rats and chickens for usually just another bottle of alcohol. And Browning's Wild Man was actually just a black man from Mississippi in some makeup. I mean, that's all he was. It's just crazy. And, you know, Browning learned how to bark. And just, that's what he did. And because of Todd Browning, we have people like Ray Bradbury, who grew up enamored of the films created by Browning and Lon Chaney, and then would later make images of, like, the dark carnival central to his work. You know, black Ferris wheels, silhouetted against lowering skies, and nameless, shapeless things in jars of formaldehyde. And that's kind of where we were with Todd. He knew what he wanted to do. 16 years old, goes on the road. And his most unusual job, and he had several with the carnival. He was an escape artist, he was a contortionist, and an acrobat. But the one that he was kind of known for was called the hypnotic living corpse. And he would pose as a recently deceased man who was buried and resurrected after a day, sometimes two. And to hear this described is absolutely, I don't know, something that I would never, ever be able to do. But basically, he would lay in a grave for like either one day or two. That's kind of what happened. And the first time had been the worst. But basically what it was, for an admission price of 25 cents, you could witness the burial of Todd Browning, who had unexpectedly, quote unquote, died the previous day. And you would receive a return ticket for his resurrection. And that was usually the following evening. And a one-day stunt was standard. But the two-day burial was trickier. They did it on Easter weekend. And it was a guaranteed crowd pleaser. And he said, you know, that first time when I heard the dirt come crashing down on that coffin, I actually shivered. But he said, in time, I almost came to enjoy the confinement. And the long hours underground were especially conducive to thought. And he made the most of his opportunity. And that period of intensive thought basically shaped Todd's destiny and was the cause of awakening that spark of genius that was within him. You're in a coffin, 6 feet underground, a ton of earth. Now, the box contained a hidden ventilation system. And he also, there's this panel that had malted milk pellets, kind of like milk duds. But basically, he sat there for either one day or sometimes two. And it's just, I can't imagine. And just to think that the crowd was like, would believe that this person was resurrected. But Browning gradually worked his way into more reputable areas of show business. He became a vaudeville performer. And then in 1913, he met D.W. Griffith, the famous director, and everything changed. Went to Hollywood, and he loved a good time. And at that time and now, Hollywood was a vice-filled playground. And don't forget, Todd grew up in like sideshows. And he grew up kind of according to the outsider's code of the carnival, which meant that he didn't really respect law and order. He didn't have any, you know, hang-ups about propriety or anything like that. He loved whiskey and he loved fast cars. And in the early morning hours of June 16th, 1915, Browning and another director, George Siegman, and an actor, Elmer Booth, were returning from a night of partying at a roadhouse known as the Vernon Country Club, which is legendary in its debauchery at the time. But the vehicle was driven by a very drunk Todd Browning. And it collided with a railway car loaded with steel rails. And the train's conductor had frantically attempted to signal the oncoming car, but Browning was too far gone to see it, and he struck the flat car at full speed, launching Elmer Booth headfirst into the rails and killing him instantly, in a Final Destination kind of death. Siegman escaped with a couple of broken ribs, a lacerated thigh, and internal injuries. And Browning was gravely injured, with a shattered leg and unspecified internal injuries, and the press publicly predicted that he would die. And one of the things is, if you go back and you read, and there's a lot of newspaper accounts at the time, where pretty much everybody's convinced that it was a railway flat car. There are sometimes people go, oh, it was just a truck. But no, it was like that. But the San Francisco Chronicle predicted outright that he would probably die. I mean, his right leg was shattered, his body painfully cut and bruised, arm, face lacerations, internal injuries. And he was taken to the California hospital, presumably to die. And everybody's like, well, you know, this might happen. You know, Todd Browning might die. But he didn't. And he recovered. It took about a year. But Elmer Booth, the guy who died in the car, and there could have been other people in the car too, which I'm going to get to in a minute. And the LA Times was really into, were there other people in the car? But Elmer Booth got married in 1908 to another actress, and they soon had a baby. And in 1909, they started working for a theater in Salt Lake City and left their baby in the care of Irene's parents. And they're in this play in March of 1910, and the grandparents brought the baby for a visit, but the baby got pneumonia. And the Salt Lake Tribune claimed that Elmer and Irene received the news that their baby was sick during one of their performances. And the parents knew what that meant, but the play must go on. A physician was sent, and mother and father suffered agony during the remainder of the play while they were amusing the public. But their son did not survive the illness. But Booth had this great future, a great stage career. And then all of a sudden, he also met Griffith. And Griffith was going to give him a huge role in this movie called Intolerance in 1916. But then again, he got killed in 1915. Now, some reports stated that when Browning was driving, there was a heavy fog. We all know that Browning was driving drunk. We don't know if he didn't see the flat car, was unable to react quickly enough. But Booth, like I said, was thrown from the car. And the LA Times reported the impresses in his skull were as even and regular as the design of a waffle off the grill. Booth was loved by the film colony. His pallbearers included Max Davidson, Robert Herron. D.W. Griffith gave the eulogy. And his sister Margaret, Booth's sister Margaret, had graduated from high school earlier that year. And Griffith, feeling guilty, offered her a job in his studio laboratory, and she became a cutter, film editor. And she had a knack for it. And she eventually worked on films for Louis B. Mayer and then MGM. And she kept doing it and doing it for decades until she rose to the ranks to become one of the most respected editors in Hollywood. And she worked until the 1980s. And in 1978, she was given an honorary Oscar for her lengthy career. She lived to be 104, passed away in 2002, but hated Todd her entire life. One of his biographers went to go interview her in the 70s, tried to get an interview about the accident. And she replied, "You expect me to talk about the man who killed my brother?" So, obviously, hold a grudge. Now, as I said, there was some question as to whether there were other people in the car. And one of the LA Times headlines says, "Were any women in motor car when actor was killed? Until two other film people who were injured are able to talk, mystery cannot be cleared." I mean, that was just straight out of the LA Times. And basically, the report at the time said that the car was a 7-passenger car, but the three guys were all in the front seat of the automobile. And everybody thought that that was kind of weird that they'd be jammed up there. But it would make more sense if there were women in the back. So we don't know at this point. I don't think anybody ever figured out whether or not there were actually women in the car. The LA Times said, "The accident takes its place in the long list of tragedies that have visited parties returning from the Vernon Country Club, a roadhouse. Reticence on the part of the survivors to reveal the number of passengers in the car has led to an investigation by the police to determine whether two women were members of the merry party returning from the roadhouse revels. A spectator reported to the police women were in the car at the time of the accident, and their mysterious identity will be the subject of a thorough investigation." So, you know, was there anybody there? Well, after the accident, despite the horrific nature of it, Browning miraculously survived. But it left him a changed man. He's not happy-go-lucky anymore. He's not the actor who was in countless comedies. Basically, he just took on this dark, somber kind of thing that would mark his work to the end of the career. So it took him about a year of recovering, and he got back working on a film, first as a writer and then as an actor. And crazy enough, his first post-accident role had him behind the wheel as the driver tasked with rushing actress Mae Marsh to save her husband from the gallows. And that was Intolerance. That was the one that Elmer Booth was supposed to be in. And Griffith also put him to work as an assistant director on Intolerance. And then he kind of works with some other directors as co-directors in a couple of things. And basically, over the next 7 years, he directed a string of now-lost films for MGM and Universal, many of which start either Story, who has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, but retired from acting when she was in her mid-20s. But the things that Browning was doing, they weren't really actually moving his career forward. It was just, yeah, we need a guy to go direct this, okay. But then he had a collaboration with Lon Chaney, beginning with The Wicked Darling from 1919. And that pulled him from the rank and file directors who would, you know, crank out things once a week into a position as one of Hollywood's bankable directors. And his reputation, Browning's reputation as one of the top directors of horror films, is because of the movies that he made with Chaney. But most of them are inaccessible or completely lost. The Unholy Three was made under the seal of approval of MGM boss Irving Thalberg, was built around a trio of criminals. And get this for 1925. A transvestite ventriloquist, played by Chaney, a dwarf, played by Harry Earls, and a strong man. And it was probably the best and most successful of the partnership. But nobody can really decide whether it was the brilliance of Chaney that made the films with Browning so stunning, or Browning's direction. But whatever the case, Chaney and Browning were a team. And you had, like, The Black Bird, and it gave Chaney an opportunity to transform himself into a cripple merely by contorting his body. Well, London After Midnight was kind of Browning's first kind of foray with the vampire myth, and it was kind of maybe supposed to be about Dracula, and then they got scared that they were going to get sued, so they kind of changed it up a little bit. Then there was the movie The Unknown, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. That was a truly disturbing tale of a circus knife thrower who pretends to have no arms and undergoes an amputation to avoid detection as a murderer. I mean, it's just absolutely nuts. And Lon Chaney, I mean, he made over 100 films, including Hunchback of Notre Dame, Phantom of the Opera. But he managed to live a very secretive life. And he had some early scandals in the L.A. theater scene, and so it caused him to shy away from public attention. And because he changed his appearance so drastically from role to role, I mean, the Man of a Thousand Faces, nobody ever recognized him when he was out. But he is one of the most notable actors of the silent era. And he was born in Colorado Springs, and his great-grandfather was a congressman. His grandmother founded the Colorado School for the Deaf and Blind. Both of Lon's parents were deaf and mute. And as a child, he learned to communicate through sign and pantomime and facial expressions. And when he was in fourth grade, his mom got sick, and Lon dropped out of school to help care for her and his younger siblings. But that was the time that he really developed his dramatic skills, because for 3 years, he would reenact the events of the day to his mom through mime and movement. And then when he was 14, he got a summer job as a tour guide at Pike's Peak. And then later that year became a prop boy at the Opera House, where his older brother was stage managing. And Chaney, you know, went around the country, toured the U.S. with a play that he co-wrote called The Little Tycoon. And when he was on tour in Oklahoma City, he met a woman called Frances Cleveland Creighton, who went by Cleva. And she joined the cast as a chorus girl. And Cleva was mentioned for her voice and reviews at the time, and she and Lon started dating. And in February 1906, they had a son named Creighton, who later went by Lon Chaney Jr. And everything was kind of going well for Lon and Cleva until that she announced that she was pregnant and wanted to go home to meet Chaney's family for Christmas. She had never met them. And Chaney and his brothers and sisters could all hear, but Chaney's parents obviously could not. But Chaney had not told this to Cleva until the moment that she actually met the parents. And she ran away from the dinner table, went to her bedroom, and then she was concerned that her child might be born deaf and crying. She made a very kind of insensitive statement, which I won't repeat here. But they have the baby. It turns out to, you know, can hear. But the incident kind of drove a wedge between the two of them that never healed. And even the story of Lon Chaney Jr.'s birth is pretty miraculous. Cleva's mom was basically a midwife, delivered hundreds, if not thousands, of babies. And she's there when Cleva is giving birth, but Lon Chaney Jr. is premature, and it looked like he wasn't going to make it. They were struggling to resuscitate him. And then Lon Sr. takes the baby outside, dips him in the freezing lake, and it worked. Lon Chaney Jr. was started awake by the cold, started crying. So Lon has a family, so he starts working a traditional job, but he missed the stage, wanted to go back to performing. So in 1910, the family picked up, moved to California. Lon started stage managing, acting, doing some choreography. Cleva became a cabaret singer. But Cleva had some problems at this time. Some people say it's because of, you know, him not telling her about the deaf parents. Some say it's because she thought that Lon was trying to kill the baby by putting it in the lake. But things came to a head in 1913 at the Majestic Theater in Los Angeles. Lon's performing, and Cleva comes out. She attempted suicide by drinking mercury dichloride backstage, and then she runs on stage from the wings. Everybody's seeing this in the audience, and it's crazy. She survived, but the poison destroyed her vocal cords, and she was never able to sing again. And the next year, she and Lon Chaney divorced, but the scandal pushed him out of the theater and marked his transition into film. But when he filed for divorce, Lon lost custody of his son because the courts said, hey, he needs to go into foster care until dad nails down steady work and a more suitable living situation. Nobody knows exactly what Lon Chaney's first film is. Everybody kind of argues about it. But by 1918, he had been in over 100 films from Universal. And when Universal wouldn't give him the raise he wanted, he went freelance. And he played in a movie, like a film called The Miracle Man. And Lon once said the stories he wanted to tell were stories of self-sacrifice or renunciation. He became known for his dedication to his roles. He was method before method was method. And he knew how to do makeup. Makeup hadn't become too prominent in the industry. He might have, you know, added a mustache to say, hey, I'm a villain. But that was about it. Studios didn't have makeup departments. Actors just were supposed to do their own. And so Lon started doing intricate makeup on himself for roles. And he had like a fishing tackle box filled with makeup and tools and strings so he could disguise or disfigure his face. He used his makeup to play more than one character. And that's why he became known as the Man of a Thousand Faces. And one of the side notes is, you know, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, he actually acquired the rights to get it made, which is kind of crazy. But if you think about it, his role in Phantom of the Opera, he used cotton, chemicals, glue, wires, fake teeth to get the look. So because of what happened with Cleva in the theater, that's why he chose to lead a very private life away from the cameras. And he once said, between pictures, there is no Lon Chaney. And my whole career is devoted to keeping people from knowing me. He rarely gave interviews. And since changing his appearance was such a big part, obviously, like I said, nobody really recognized him. He got married again in 1914 or 1915. Nobody's sure exactly what year. But to a chorus girl named Hazel Hastings. And they stayed out of the spotlight, but remained married until his death. And Lon worked steadily throughout the 1920s. And one of the things I talked about, The Unholy Three, that was a sound movie. And the public had never heard his voice before, so they were clamoring to hear it in the movie. And Lon Chaney specifically chose the film as his first talkie because of its strange and powerful plot, and because the character uses five distinctly different voices. But The Unholy Three was the only sound film Lon Chaney ever did. In the winter of 1929, he got pneumonia followed by lung cancer, and that was made worse when he worked on a film with artificial snow that got stuck in his throat and caused an infection. And on August 26, 1930, he passed away at just 47 years old. So, not very old. But, you know, pallbearers at his funeral included Irving Thalberg, Lionel Barrymore, Todd Browning. There was also a chaplain and an honor guard from the U.S. Marine Corps who had made Chaney an honorable member, honorary member, because he had played the drill instructor. Now, Todd, let's get back to him. Between 1917 and 23, he worked steadily. Did a whole bunch of films, like I said. And he was popular and bankable, but his personal life was out of control. He was a functional alcoholic. But Browning had always been kind of able to keep his drinking in check. According to one of his friends, a director, Raoul Walsh, said, yeah, I was aware of Browning's drinking, but never saw him lose control. I knew he was from Kentucky because he was always talking about Kentucky whiskey. He always had a bottle of Laughing Water with him. He never got drunk, though. You know, that's somebody covering for somebody, and, you know, that's pretty nice of him. I appreciate that. But he just was out of control. And his career, his marriage were threatened by this alcoholism. He was basically blacklisted in 1923 and 1924. And, you know, his friend Walsh said he'd stay up half the night drinking and playing cards and then come to the studio in the morning looking as fresh as a daisy. But after a time, this sham no longer worked. He lost his contract with Universal. His wife separated from him for a period of several months. And basically, you know, this 2 years that he was inactive from the screen, he needed it, you know, to basically so he could, you know, get a job back at Clean and get sober. And when he came back is when he made The Unholy Three. And the film was an astonishing hit. And the New York Times called it one of 1925's 10 best pictures. And this was like the year that Ben-Hur came out. The New York Times critics said it was a startlingly original achievement which takes its place with the very best productions that have been made. So now you have Browning going, huh, I got two winning elements here. And they're going to shape the rest of his career. The first, Circus Sideshow, which obviously he knew very well. And the second was Lon Chaney himself, right? If I do carnival stuff and I have Lon Chaney, then, you know, I can do something and I will be a success. Now, I mentioned this one movie, and it was in 1927, The Unknown, and it has a very young Joan Crawford as this scantily clad carnival girl over whom Chaney's armless knife thrower obsesses. This is probably a precursor to Freaks, and I'll probably do a Freaks episode, like a second part or something to this. But it was crazy. And The Unknown, I don't know how Lon Chaney really pulled it off. It's an amazing physical performance. He's armless, right? He flings daggers with his feet. And he doesn't have any arms. He's in love with his assistant, Joan Crawford, a woman who just so happens cannot bear to be touched by the hands of any men. And basically, it turns out in the movie that Lon Chaney's character, Alonzo, does actually have two perfectly good arms, but he keeps them bound to his body by special straps. And he also had two thumbs on his left hand. And he's got a dwarf assistant. And he wants Joan Crawford's character. And he figures out he's got this plan. And so he has, like, his dwarf assistant unbind him and release his strapped-up arms. But he's had this disguise. You know, he's wearing it all the time. So he's got to beat on his arms to bring them back to life. And while he's thinking of the plan, he lights a cigarette. I want you guys just to think about this. He lights a cigarette with his feet and smokes, staring into space. Alonzo never uses his arms. So even unbound, he does everything with his legs and feet. Think about what Lon Chaney had to do to make this movie. And it goes off into this horrible kind of thing. And it's just, I've never seen it. I've just read a lot of descriptions about it. And it sounds absolutely bonkers. Not bonkers, but another movie, which is probably Todd Browning's most famous film, other than Dracula, most people have not seen it. And it's called London After Midnight. And this is the one that I said was kind of the precursor to where they're like end around about Dracula. And it was released in 1927. Lon Chaney's got dual roles. But the last known print of London After Midnight was destroyed along with hundreds of other films in a fire that leveled one of MGM's vaults in 1967. It is probably the most famous of all missing films. It has become the holy grail of archivists and film collectors. The last known record of the film existing was in the mid-1950s. So, film historians William K. Everson and David Bradley both saw the film in the early 1950s. And an MGM vault inventory from 1955 shows the print being stored in vault number 7. And a fire in vault 7 in the 60s appears to have destroyed the last surviving print. With all the publicity that it's received, it's doubtful that it resides in a foreign archive. The film was never sold to independent distributors, nor were the rights sold to another studio for a remake, so prints of the film would not have been available to anyone outside of MGM. And unlike a lot of independent distributors, the studio was very diligent about collecting prints after the completion of their print run, so it's unlikely that a retired projectionist has a copy hiding in his attic. And everybody was kind of looking forward to 2022 because the copyright on the film was going to expire. And that way, if a private collector had it, it was going to surface and so they could sell it. Was it a good film? If you talk to like people who, I don't even know because nobody's seen it since the 50s. But if you look at, you know, reviews and things like that, people think it probably wouldn't be really well received now. It just has this mystery about it because of the fact that it's lost. It was shot in 24 days for $152,000, the shortest schedule, the lowest budget of any Chaney's MGM films. Foreign bookings were below average, but domestic sales were $721,000. And honestly, I think that's more than Dracula made. So the film earned $500,000 profit for the studio, which was one of the top figures for any of Chaney's films. So, you know, it did pretty well. Well, Todd basically had resumed heavy drinking. The same thing that had got him blacklisted in the early 1920s. So MGM says, sorry, you gotta go. And one of the places that he was gonna go was Universal, because they had acquired the exclusive rights to Dracula for $40,000. They wanted him, and they picked him up because Universal hoped that Lon Chaney would follow. But Chaney died before that happened. It's likely that if Chaney had been in it, it would be a completely different film, because his makeup, he wasn't just going to be just standing there. He was going to do something with all that makeup. And Dracula was a critical and financial hit. Sold 50,000 tickets in 2 days. It grossed $700,000, but that's 1931 as opposed to the London one, which is 1927, which did a little bit more. But still, in 1931, it was Universal's most profitable release. But it's a flawed film. And Todd Browning really didn't do that great of a job. He had directed just two talkies prior to Dracula. He didn't really understand the medium at that point. And the direction was flat. The editing was uneven. He ignored continuity. There's two scenes that a large piece of cardboard used to cut the glare from a lamp is clearly visible. It takes up nearly a quarter of the screen. And there was one of the co-stars of it, a guy named David Manners, remembered Browning as a disinterested director. So Todd Browning was always off to the side somewhere. And the cinematographer, Carl Freund, is generally agreed for any kind of film success, it was because of him. And that's kind of where everybody thinks that any of the success came from. I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot of interviews with people that were on it. But Freund was so fed up with Browning's static ways that he finally just turned on the camera and let it run unattended. If you go watch the movie, there's one endless take in the finished film. And it has Manners, Chandler, and Van Sloan. It runs 251 feet, which is 3 minutes without a cut. It was clearly meant to be broken up with close-ups and reaction shots. But no, it's just one thing. And some people say, okay, Freund didn't do that great of a job either. But Todd Browning just, there's also maybe that Universal was, you know, shortchanging him and he wanted more money and stuff like that. There was that argument too. But 1931 came out on Valentine's Day, hugely successful, and not the kind of movie you would expect on Valentine's Day. I will talk to you guys later.